welcome everybody. Let's start by cultivating our motivation. And get a sense of what being in cyclic existence means, being bound by afflictions and karma, not having freedom to have the happiness we want, because we're tied by the karma we've created, the actions we've created. And we've created those actions under the influence of ignorance, clinging, attachment, and anger. And so we're bound by those afflictions, by the actions, and then not free. So in order to remedy this situation, we need to eliminate the ignorance, anger, and attachment, and thus stop the karma and stop the suffering in samsara, in cyclic existence. But we want to do this, to attain this liberated state, not for ourselves alone, because we're simply one being, but in order to have the capability to benefit all living beings and show them how to eliminate the afflictions and karma in their mind streams so they can be free of cyclic existence as well and attain a state of lasting happiness. And so it's for that reason that we're here this evening to listen to teachings. So take a minute and cultivate that motivation. Discussion about rebirth, and you know, is rebirth important as part of the Buddha's teachings, and you know, how does it contribute to your Dharma understanding? Well, if we look at the motivation that we just cultivated, yeah, if we were thinking that it's just our afflictions, our ignorance, anger, and attachment of this life that create our actions of this life, that bring the results of this life, then it becomes a little bit difficult, doesn't it? Because you have babies and infants who are newly born, and if there was only this life, then how come some babies have one personality, some another, some, you know, sleep well, some don't? You know, it's not all controlled by our genes. Yeah? So there would be that kind of problem if we didn't talk about rebirth. And also, can you see that when we talk about rebirth and place the afflictions, the karma, the way we're trapped by these and compelled to experience the results of our own actions created by ignorance, anger, and attachment. Can you see how that it gives this much more depth and breadth if we have a view of multiple lifetimes? Because if it all ended in, if there was only this lifetime, we would have a hard time explaining why good people have suffering. And then we would also have a hard time explaining why people who didn't do, you know, who did a lot of, you know, negative actions seem to have no repercussion ever, because when this life ceases, they go out of existence. Yeah. So you would have that kind of problem of making sense of there being a moral causality in our life. But it does give a much more depth if you feel, wow, that what we've been experiencing, it's not just this life. This has been going on a long time. this is really serious business. It's not just a fluke that I was born out of no causes randomly, but, you know, I was born due to my own karma, and then, you know, trace that back to ignorance. And then when you think of other people's, you know, situation and their unsatisfactory situation, then it also is more powerful when you think, oh, this has been going on a long time for them as well. It's not that they, you know, just this life kind of were created out of nothing with afflictions and karma. Yeah. And then also, when you think about the kindness of other sentient beings towards us, putting that in the perspective of multiple lifetimes, it's really quite powerful, isn't it? Now, when you think that all these infinite living beings have been our parents in one lifetime or another, have, you know, done all the work they do in society to grow the food and build the houses and make the clothes that we use, and, you know, how kind sentient beings have been, not just this life, but just beginning this time, makes a big difference if you think on this broader perspective of multiple lifetimes, doesn't it? So it adds some urgency to the practice, and more of a feeling of what suffering means and what kindness means and of the importance of practicing the Dharma. But like I said at our lunchtime discussion, people can certainly practice the Dharma and benefit from the teachings without a belief in rebirth. And it's something people have to think about over a period of time. You know, it's not that you just hear it once and, oh yeah, I believe. I mean, if you were brought up that way, you probably would. But if you weren't, then, you know, kind of our society where, you know, there's this life and you are your body and your mind is just some fluke that kind of came out of your brain and it all ends when you die. You know, if you're brought up like that, then it's going to take some time to get a feeling of mind as an entity that's separate from the body and there being a continuity of mind and a causal, you know, thing of one moment of consciousness causing the next moment of consciousness. Okay? Yes.
It sounds, the way you speak of it, almost as though if you don't believe in rebirth, then you believe in the nihilist. Couldn't you have a position that doesn't hold either of those views?
Okay, so your question is that it sounds like if you don't believe in rebirth, then you're a nihilist. So isn't there a position that where you're not a nihilist and you're not an absolutist? So yeah, can you give that position, what that position would be?
Somebody who doesn't know.
Oh, yeah. Yes, somebody who is saying, I don't know if I believe in rebirth. Of course, there's lots of people who are like that. Yeah? But that's very different than saying, I don't believe in rebirth, isn't it? Yeah? Saying, I don't know, I have doubt, I'm investigating. You know, fair enough. I mean, we all need to do that. But it's when you say, you know, baloney. Yeah, that's when you fall into nihilism. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? It's heating up in this corner of the room.
I've got more, but I'll keep it.
Well, we'll have a little debate, huh? We'll have a little debate. Yeah. And then you can tell me how if it all starts in this lifetime, why little babies experience suffering. That's your assignment. Please explain that to me. You don't have to tonight. Okay. Okay. So we've been talking about the taking and giving meditation. And I was reading last time some of the quotations from different scriptures that our author Namkapal put in the book. So I'll continue that. I'll just review something that he said last time. So this is a quote from Shantideva. Whoever is keen to give swift protection to both himself and others should practice the sublime secret of equalizing and exchanging self and others. So you protect yourself and you protect others by exchanging who you feel is the most important one. Okay? So you protect yourself from the pain of self-centeredness. You protect others from the pain of having to live with you when you're self-centered. And it's true, isn't it? Yeah, because sometimes, I mean, our self-centeredness is a big, we're the one who's mostly damaged by our self-centeredness. But it's kind of a pain in the neck for the people we live with, too, isn't it? Yeah. And so whereas when we're more intent on cherishing others, then the people around us benefit so much. And, you know, then just by living there, doing what we're doing, we create peace in the environment, in the atmosphere. Shantideva also said, if you do not actually exchange your happiness for the suffering of others, you will not become enlightened nor find any joy in cyclic existence. Whoa! If you do not actually exchange your happiness for the suffering of others, you will not become enlightened. Why won't you become enlightened? Yeah, you don't generate bodhicitta. Why do you need bodhicitta to become enlightened?
Bodhicitta is the wish to become fully enlightened.
For
the benefit of others.
Okay, so bodhicitta is the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others.
If you don't have the wish, you're not going to get there.
So if you don't have the wish, then you're not going to create the causes to get there, are you? Yeah? Okay. And so then also, if you don't exchange your happiness for the suffering of others, you won't find any joy in cyclic existence. Why not?
Because your own self-centeredness just leads to misery.
Yeah, because your own self-centeredness just leads you to misery time and time again in this very life. And our self-centeredness lies behind the negative karma we create too, which causes more misery in cyclic existence. Okay. Another verse from Shantideva. Therefore, in order to allay harm to yourself and to pacify the pains of others, offer yourself in the service of others and protect them as you would yourself. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. Therefore, in order to allay harm to yourself and to pacify the pains of others, to alleviate your own misery and the misery of others, offer yourself in the service of others and protect them as you would yourself. Yeah, it's very beautiful, isn't it? What happens when it comes to doing it? What happens? Offer yourself in the service of others. Today was a flex day. We didn't get much of a flex, did we? We were preparing beds, we were planting, we were doing laundry, we were doing all sorts of things. Offer yourself in the service of others. Did we do all that stuff with a happy mind, or did we do it with a mind that says, I will get away? Yeah? So what kind of mind did we do it with? Well, were you happy? Were you miserable? Some people miserable, some people happy. Okay? So some people were, the people who were happy were offering themselves in the service of others. So those people allayed harm to themselves and pacified the suffering of others. The people who did it because they felt they had to, but they were quite resentful, did they allay harm to themselves and pacify the suffering of others? No. In fact, their self-centeredness gave them more harm, didn't it? Yeah. So they're doing the same things, but with the mind going... I watched The Lion at MGM. Okay. But it's true, these words are so beautiful, but sometimes when it's, you know, offer this third line, offer yourself in the service to others. You know, sometimes our mind just says, I don't want to. I want somebody to offer themselves in the service to me. Yeah. Okay, so it's a beautiful verse, but it can be really hard to do. But what is it that makes it hard to do? What is it that makes it hard to do? Yeah, the self-centeredness. We'd rather be doing something for ourselves. So it's our mind that makes it difficult, isn't it? It's the mind that makes it difficult. Yeah. I mean, we do have physical limitations, of course, and we have to take those into account. You know, I'm not negating the physical limitations because, you know, the body can only do so much before you keel over. But it's amazing how much the mind just affects what we do, isn't it? Okay. Offer yourself in the service of others and protect them as you would yourself. And so, if you have a mind that's happy, you can say, I want to protect others the way I would protect myself. You know, I want them to be happy the way I want myself to be happy. I want to protect myself from the pain of my own self-centeredness as much as and I want to protect them from that pain as well. Yeah? So, you know, we can do that, or we can think in another way. And it's all up to us, isn't it? All up to us. Okay? And Shantideva also said, whatever the agonies of sentient beings may be, may they all ripen on me alone. Okay. Again, what a beautiful thought. May all the agony of sentient beings ripen on me. May I have a mind that is strong enough to bear all the misery of the world. Yeah, isn't that a beautiful thought? May my mind be strong enough to bear all the suffering in the world without getting discouraged, without getting resentful, without feeling sorry for myself. Yeah? So it's a beautiful thought, not only for others, but for ourselves, don't you think? Wouldn't you like to have a mind that is strong enough to bear the sufferings of the world? Yeah? Because if we could bear the sufferings of the world, then bearing our own suffering is a cinch, isn't it? Yeah? But we have a hard time bearing our own suffering. Yeah? A little least bit suffering, and like, you know, we disintegrate. But it's a beautiful prayer, an aspiration to kind of train the mind in. You know, may my mind be strong enough to bear all the suffering of living beings, so that whatever the agonies of sentient beings may they all ripen on me alone. And when they ripen, may my mind be peaceful, may it be calm, may I feel that I have meaning and purpose in my life, may I bear the suffering with a good heart. Yeah. So you can see that if we have that way of thinking, then even when our own suffering happens, we can transform our own suffering into the path to enlightenment. Because then when we're suffering ourselves, we think, I'm taking on the suffering of all beings. I'm training in being a bodhisattva. I'm voluntarily taking on the suffering of all beings in, you know, whatever I'm experiencing. But then when you think about it, then what you're experiencing, is it anything like the suffering of other living beings? If what we experience in the hell realm as misery, does it come close? Forget taking on the suffering of all living beings. Does it come close to taking on the suffering of one living being in the hell realm? You know, our suffering seems like nothing, doesn't it? I mean, could we even pray if our beloved mother or beloved father, beloved friend were born in the hell realm, could we really sincerely think, I will take on all their suffering? Just of one person? Yeah? Okay? So you can see that when suffering comes to us, just automatically, we don't go out looking for it, it comes automatically. But when it comes, if we had that mind, that I'm bearing the suffering of others, doesn't that help us even bear our own suffering in a totally different way? Because then we start to think, okay, you know, I have a stomachache, I'm bearing the suffering of all living beings. Then you think, I'm only experiencing a suffering, a stomachache, you know. This is nothing like the hungry ghost experience or the hell realm beings or even human beings who, you know, have a stomachache because they don't have enough food and they're starving to death. And then it makes you reflect on your own suffering and it goes, actually, you know, this is kind of manageable. It feels bad if I compare it to how I'd like to feel if my suffering feels rotten and awful. But if I compare it to how it could be, I kind of got off the hook easy, didn't it? Also, considering the amount of negative karma we've created. I have a stomachache. I got off easy. Yeah? Okay, and then you think, may this be the misery of all sentient beings. Yeah? And then just thinking that way helps you bear your own misery in a totally different mental state. Okay? So we have to practice that now when we're not in intense suffering. But just practice it even when small things happen. Yeah. Sometimes like last time I think I was using really small examples of how we get bent out of shape. And somebody may say, oh, I should teaching about, you know, you stub your toe and you go into this fit of rage about how the world isn't kind enough to you. You know, sometimes I use those small examples because it shows us how petty we are. And not that we ourselves, but what the self-centered mind does, how petty the self-centered mind makes us. And then it gives us some ability to maybe step back and say, if I can't bear some tiny, tiny thing, how am I going to even bear my own death? Yeah? I mean, old age is coming, isn't it? Yeah? And we're not going to feel as well as we feel when we're younger. And then death, you know, it's not a picnic if you don't have realizations. So how are we going to bear that if we can't bear being inconvenienced in the smallest, tiniest way? Yeah? So this meditation is extremely effective for when we're in a bad mood or when our mind is complaining about things, to just say, to put our own experience into some kind of perspective and to realize how much our mind makes us suffer when it has a certain attitude. Yeah? That the situation isn't actually that bad, but our mind makes us so miserable. And so then this way of thinking really is such a tremendous purification for the mind. Hmm? Yeah. And then we understand why bodhisattvas pray to have problems. Yeah? Because it's like, oh good, I get to purify some negative karma. And oh good, you know, my self-centeredness is getting whacked down, which is good, it's my enemy. And, oh, good, I get to do something really beneficial for sentient beings. How wonderful. Yeah? And so bodhisattvas, you know, kind of, something's inconvenient, oh, goody. Yeah? We're like, something's inconvenient. It's just all our mind. Okay? So that's why we're listening to Dharma teachings, isn't it? Because we're all trying, we're all sitting here together, all trying to change our mind. Okay. The Ornament of Great Vehicle Sutras. Okay, so it's the Mahayana Sutra Alankara by Maitreya. says, finding the mind that equalizes self and others or values others more than self is good. Thus it is taught that others' welfare is superior to one's own. Okay? So the benefit, you know, on one level, we all grew up, you know, share with others, and others are very important, and be kind to others, because we were taught to really feel empathy and be sensitive to what was going on with others. When we really investigate very profoundly, we see that when we help others, we're actually the major beneficiary of it. Yeah? When we were brought up, we usually think if I'm kind to others, they benefit, but I might lose out. But when you really think about it, we're the major beneficiary. And that's what His Holiness Dalai Lama says. He says, if I act with compassion, you know, maybe the other person gets some benefit, maybe they don't. But he says, I get all the benefit of being compassionate. Yeah? And so we see that if we're really successful in changing how the mind looks at these things and really thinking of others' well-being, you know, as important as our own or as more important, then, you know, the mind, what makes us happy and miserable, completely changes. Yeah, and we receive so much benefit when we have the opportunity, yeah, to do something for others. You know, one of the people who came here today said, I love coming here because you people are so happy. Yeah. Now, when you hear that from somebody who's a visitor for a few hours, doesn't that make you feel that what you're doing is worthwhile? Yeah. Even though at that minute you're thinking, I don't feel happy, I want to go do something else. You know? But when you hear somebody say, wow, I feel happy coming here because you people are happy, then you feel, oh, wow, what I'm doing offends somebody in a good way. That makes me happy. And then even if somebody leaves and they're not happy, yeah, oh, discipline's too tough at Shravasti Abbey. Got to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. Too tough here. You know, can't talk all the time. Can't watch movies. You know, all these things, you know, and they leave, you know, but still, a lot of these people, they leave and they think about their experience. And we hear from them later on, don't we? Yeah? A number of these people we hear from later on and saying, thank you, or I benefited from that experience. Or, you know, the seeds were planted, and so people benefit. Okay, the 70 prayer says, I would not mind being thrown into any of the hell realms as a result of the slightest misdeed by sentient beings who are afflicted by poisonous, disturbing emotions. Wow. That's a highly realized mind that thinks that, isn't it? I would not mind being thrown into any of the hells as a result of the slightest misdeed by sentient beings who are afflicted by poisonous, disturbing emotions. So others are so afflicted by their ignorance, anger, and attachment that they create large misdeeds and small misdeeds. But this bodhisattva is saying, even for a small misdeed, if it's going to prevent somebody else from suffering, I'm happy to be reborn in the hell realm to benefit them in that way. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to think? Yeah? Wouldn't you love to actually feel that way? Wouldn't you love to have a mind that's strong enough that can bear that? And happy enough that can bear that? Okay. Whatever the agonies of beings may be, I volunteer to accept them all. So same kind of thing. So this is why when we do the taking and giving meditation, we start taking with our own misery that we're going to experience anyway, that we don't even want to have. But we start doing it, taking our own misery of tomorrow, our own old age, our own death, our own future life suffering. We start with that, and then we start expanding it from there, going out and out to more and more beings, until we get to the point where we could say, whatever the agonies of beings may be, I volunteer to accept them all. Yeah. I volunteer, not, well, I guess I better, otherwise I'm not really practicing very well. Or I guess I better take their suffering because otherwise I'm just being a bad sport and they're going to know what a lousy practitioner I am. Okay? But really a mind that has gone back and actually done these meditations so that the mind is transformed. That's why I was saying before, if you try and jump from where we are now directly to taking on other suffering, we're going to feel resentful. We're going to feel incapable. But if we really follow this path that's been explained in this book, you know, and we think about the 7 points, 7-point instruction for cultivating bodhicitta, and we think about equanimity and equalizing self and others and the faults of self-centeredness and the benefits of cherishing others and exchanging self and others, then when we come to this part's easy. Okay? But we really have to do the whole practice and think of all these steps along the way. Yeah? Because it's just a cause and effect process. Yeah? If you meditate well on the earlier steps, the later steps are going to be easier. And if you skip the earlier steps and try and go on to the later ones, they're going to be hard. Yeah, it's just cause and effect. May they always engage in virtue and be satisfied by supreme happiness. So that's also our wish for sentient beings. May they always engage in virtue. Yeah, so may sentient beings not commit any kind of negative karma. May they only engage in virtue. And may they be satisfied by the supreme happiness that comes from the mind repeatedly engaging in virtue. And so part of our Dharma practice is actively training in these steps. And part of our Dharma practice is when we fall into a mood that says, I don't feel like this and I don't want to, working with that mind. So skillfully learning how to be a doctor to our own mind. Instead of when we get in that thing saying, I'm such a lousy practitioner, I'm never going to get to Buddhahood, because I'd much rather have a chocolate milkshake than talk to one more sentient being, you know. So don't kind of, you know, get down on yourself. That doesn't do any good. Okay? But just keep on practicing. Extend some kindness to yourself. Keep on go back and do the earlier meditations. Make the aspirations. What was that one of, I want to do this. Yeah? Yeah? Where did that come from? We were just talking about it. That was EML? Yeah. Yeah. You know, I want to be able to overcome my bad moods. I want to be able to take on the suffering of others. Okay? So really, you know, spend time on the aspirations. The special verses collected by topic say, your body and your life should be given to all sentient beings. Love and compassion should be given equally to all living creatures. Okay. It's one thing to say love and compassion should be given equally to all living creatures. Definitely, people should love me equal to how they love everybody else, if not more. And they should be more compassionate to me like to everybody else, if not more. Okay, that one's good. Okay. But my body and my life should be given to all sentient beings. Okay. But then when we look at what is this body, why do we think it's my body? When you have children, you're giving parts of your body to sentient beings, aren't you? Yeah, if you have a kid, you get part of your body. Was it excruciating? No, you had a good time. Okay? So here we're talking also, you know, a little bit different, but, you know, giving part of our body to sentient beings. Okay. Earnestly wishing all evil to ripen upon your mind stream, rejoice in all merit, and think of the great being, the Buddha. Okay? We're earnestly wishing for all the negativities to ripen on our mind stream, not on other sentient beings. Okay? And then rejoice in all our own merit, all the merit of all the other sentient beings, all the goodness there is in the world. And think of the great being, the Buddha. And I find this very, very helpful. You know, when there's these practices that seem so kind of wonderful, but how am I ever going to get myself to be able to do them? Then think of the Buddha, and think of how the Buddha was once just like us. You know, the Buddha wasn't always a Buddha. Eons ago, Shakyamuni was probably sitting and whimpering and whining because something didn't go the way he wanted. Yeah, he's just like us. But then the thing is that he followed the path. And so we know that if we follow the path, because cause and effect functions, if we follow the same path and create the same causes as the Buddha did, we'll get the same result. Okay. So thinking about the Buddha in those times when it seems difficult to practice, I think is very inspiring. Yeah. And then you think about how the Buddha's been trying to help us and lead us to enlightenment for ages. Yeah, quite inspiring. Okay, and it also said you should give away your body, life, and mind. Okay, we can't actually give away our mind, but we can certainly give away our good wishes. Or we could give away our mind in the sense of putting our mind to use for the benefit of all beings, instead of for the use of our self-centeredness. Let all the misdeeds of all living beings ripen on me. By accepting all their misdeeds, may these beings avoid suffering. Okay, so again, so you see in so many Mahayana scriptures, that's why he's quoting the same thing again and again. So many of the Mahayana scriptures are saying the same thing. Let all the misdeeds of all living beings ripen on me, and by accepting these, may they be free of suffering. And so when you do the taking and giving, you know, really doing that and thinking of somebody being relieved of their own misery and really picture that person in a suffering state, and then because you took on their suffering, that they're happy and think, wow, how nice. Yeah, but I can use my life to make somebody else happy. Make others' suffering your own and give your own happiness to others. Okay? So others' suffering, make it my own, my happiness, give to others. But then if we sometimes think of my happiness, what happiness am I going to give to them? Okay? The happiness of having cookies after lunch. Okay? Well, when it's, you know, I want cookies after lunch, that seems like a huge happiness, doesn't it? I want cookies after lunch. Oh, I get cookies after lunch. But then when you think of, I'm going to give the happiness of having cookies after lunch to somebody else, does that seem like a big happiness to give away? No, it doesn't, does it? Seems kind of insufficient as a happiness to give away. But why are we so attached to having it for ourselves then? Okay? Yeah? So when you think of the happiness that you want to give away, you want to give away a really good kind of happiness, don't you? You know? Oh, you know, when we think of like, oh, somebody could give me $1,000. Wow, I'm going to be really happy getting $1,000. You know, it feels like so much happiness. But then you think, I'm going to give the happiness of having $1,000 to somebody else. You know, how does that feel? Well, if you imagine giving $1,000 to somebody who's homeless, that's nice. Yeah. But is it going to solve all that person's problems? No. They'd probably spend it in a day or, you know, get something for their family. But it doesn't solve the basic problem, does it? So we want to give them a big happiness, a bigger happiness than $1,000. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, when we put our own happiness and suffering into this kind of perspective? Because when they're happening, they both seem like such a big deal and so important. But when we think of, you know, giving that amount of happiness to somebody else, it seems rather insufficient. And when we think of somebody else having that amount of suffering and taking it on ourselves, it also seems, you know, the suffering of not having cookies after lunch. Yeah? Do you have the courage to take that on from sentient beings? The suffering of not having cookies after lunch? Sure, I can take that on. That's no problem. But when we want cookies after lunch and we don't have them, that suffering is enormous, it seems like, isn't it? But when we think of taking it from somebody else, oh, what a little suffering. So do you see how our perceptions are very, very skewed? What we consider happiness and suffering. Yeah? Everything pertaining to the self becomes so much larger than, you know, is reasonable. And then the regular confession of Samvara's ritual also says, may the miseries of all sentient beings mature on me, and may they enjoy happiness due to my virtues. In all my lives, may my three doors, body, speech, and mind, be transformed into the excellent vase and the wish-granting tree. Okay? So the miseries of others mature on me, may they enjoy the happiness and results from my virtues. And in all my lives, may my body, speech, and mind become like a jewel that grants all the wishes and a vase that provides anything and everything that others need. I remember when I was in maybe third or fourth grade, we had an assignment to write and draw, you know, one wish that we really wanted to come true. Yeah? What's the wish you really, really want to come true? Okay. So you know what I did? I was very smart. I wish that all my wishes could come true. So, one for a kid wanted a bicycle, somebody wanted, I wanted every, you know, my one wish was that all my wishes came true. But this is the idea behind a wish-fulfilling vase or a wish-fulfilling jewel, is that all your material wishes in samsara come true. But again, when you compare those material wishes to, you know, the happiness that comes from practicing Dharma, those material wishes aren't very much happiness, are they? In fact, sometimes they become a nuisance. The more things you have, the more things you have to take care of. Okay. So this is now Namgyal Pel himself is speaking. So this is what is taught in many of the great vehicles texts containing the Buddha's words and commentaries to them. But should you wonder whether there are not those who belong definitely and ultimately to the lineage of hearers and solitary realizers, and if so, how it could be possible for all sentient beings to become Buddhists, you should know that the presentations of the three vehicles is interpretable for temporary purposes, whereas in the ultimate and definitive sense, there is only one vehicle. So what they're saying here is, you know, here we're talking about all sentient beings becoming Buddhas, but there are some of the Mahayana teachings that are called, where they teach three final vehicles. In other words, there's some they say in them that some people definitely have what's called a hearer lineage or a solitary realizer lineage or a bodhisattva lineage, meaning they have the potential, yeah, to attain the result of one of those three vehicles. So they say in these scriptures that, let's say, somebody who has the lineage of a hearer, then that person is going to become a hearer arhat, and that's it, you know. And then they're going to go into the peaceful nirvana of a hearer arhat, and that's it. They never practice the bodhisattva path. They never attain full enlightenment. Okay? Then they would say, similarly, for a person with a solitary realizer lineage, you know, then they would just attain the solitary realizer arhatship and never practice bodhicitta, and that's it. Okay? So they would say there's three final vehicles in terms of you gain the result of that vehicle and you stop there. And then in those same scriptures, they say that there may be some sentient beings that are of indefinite lineage. In other words, depending on what teacher they meet, they may become a hearer or a solitary realizer or a bodhisattva. Yeah, so if they meet a hearer teacher, then they'll follow the hearer path and attain that hearer arhatship. If they meet a bodhisattva teacher, they'll follow a Mahayana path and attain Buddhahood. So that's what these scriptures say. So then the question is, well, wait a minute. Are there three final vehicles, or is there one final vehicle where everybody will eventually become a Buddha and everybody has the potential to become a Buddha? And so he's saying here that those teachings of the three final vehicles was a skillful means given by the Buddha, but actually there's just one final vehicle. Now, why would the Buddha teach that there's three final vehicles? Because some people, if they thought that they would eventually have to become fully enlightened, they would probably faint on the spot because the path seems too hard and so too difficult for them. Okay? And they just throw their hands up and run away. So rather than have them do that, the Buddha is very skillful and says, oh, but here's arhatship. You don't have to collect nearly as much merit. You free yourself from cyclic existence. The path is much shorter. It's much easier. And then that person says, oh, that's true. Yes, I can become a hearer arhat. You know, that's what I want to do. Okay, so that way at least the Buddha gets that person going on the path. Yeah, but the Buddha is very sneaky. Because after he gets us going on the path, once our mind is stronger and we can bear more, then he's going to tell those arhats that they still have to become Buddhas because sentient beings are suffering. So that's why they say if we can start out in the Mahayana at the beginning, it's better. If you can't, practice, you know, and attain arhatship. Yeah. And maybe it's more skillful just to say, yes, that's it, and attain that goal. And then later on, bring it to the person that, oh, you know, come and practice the path to full enlightenment too. It's kind of like when you have a little kid in a car ride, you know. I remember driving in the car with my parents, and sometimes on the weekend we would go one place and it was an hour and a half ride away, which to me it was like 10 hours. An hour and a half sitting in the car when you're a little kid is like you know. And so what would they do? It's like, oh well, we're not going all the way there, we're going to go someplace shorter, you know. So we get to someplace shorter, then we take a break, we'd run around, oh let's go a little bit longer and get further, you know. Like that. Yeah? Okay. And so, I mean, parents, you know what you have to do to get your kids to do things. So, you know, say, oh, we're just going to do a little bit. You know, you get them there, and they're still okay. Oh, let's do a little bit more. They're okay. Oh, let's do a little bit more. Okay. So it's a skillful way as a parent and as a Buddha to guide sentient things. You know, doing it this way. Buddha's quite skillful. Okay. I saw this cartoon in a Buddhist magazine. You know, mom and dad in the front seat and the kids in the back seat and the road sign, you know, straight ahead to Nirvana, and the kids are saying, "Are we almost there?" Yeah. Okay, the expression of the names of Manjushri says, the result of one vehicle is present in the three vehicles' determination to be free. Okay, so what it's saying there is the result of one vehicle, you know, that's the Buddha's thought, the Buddha's intention, when he's talking about the three vehicles, having three vehicles, it's actually present in there, is to get them all to full enlightenment. There are many such quotations in the Great Vehicle. Having familiarized yourself with giving and taking to some extent, the way to practice it concisely is as follows. And the text says these two should be made to ride on the breath. Okay? So this is this line, these two should be made to ride on the breath, this is from the actual text of the 7-point mind training. Okay, then Nankapel's commentary. When you have acquired some training in the preceding process, as you inhale, imagine that you are giving your body... No, as you exhale... I knew something was wrong. As you exhale, imagine that you are giving your body possessions and virtues of the three times to all sentient beings under the sky, and that they thereby obtain ultimate and uncontaminated bliss. As you inhale, you should imagine you are taking into your heart all the sufferings of every being in the three realms, as well as their causes, and that they are thereby completely freed from all misery and its causes. Practicing in this way, the breath and the mind will flow in the same direction, so you will overcome distraction and strengthen mindfulness. So that whole long teaching that we just did, you know, all these different ways of taking on the suffering of, you know, individuals and then of groups and then of all the realms and then of the whole, you know, the Aryas and then of taking on the suffering of the environment. Then you do that when you get proficient, then you do that all when you're inhaling. Okay? And then when you're exhaling, you know, the whole long meditation of giving our body, you know, transforming it to others, what other sentient beings need, giving our possessions to transforming and multiplying them, giving our merit, you know, transforming and multiplying them, giving them to all sentient beings. That whole meditation and giving them to the different realms and the different beings and the environment, that all happens as you exhale. So you get to be, you have to be pretty proficient in the practice to be able to really stay focused on what you're doing and make it something that's really heartfelt. I think for us right now, it's better, you know, sometimes when we're on our cushion to spend a long time just doing one part of it so that we get that kind of familiarity with it. And then sometimes, like when we're walking around, just practice doing it as we inhale and exhale, okay? But it's interesting because it says, practicing in this way, the mind and the breath will flow in the same direction. So we're coordinating the mind and the breath, you know, and they always say that the mind rides on the breath. So when you have a virtuous mind like this, then, you know, the breath, the internal energy, the chi, the wind, that's going to be subdued by the power of the virtue of your thought as you're doing this. Okay, so they flow in the same direction. So you will overcome distraction and strengthen mindfulness. So when you have to do this kind of meditation, you really have to be right on it. You can't space out, can you? Because an in-breath and an out-breath don't last very long. So you overcome distraction and you increase your mindfulness. Yeah, just as factors that will help you in concentration. But then especially in this meditation, you're overcoming distraction, which would mean distraction to your own self-centeredness. And increasing mindfulness would be mindfulness of the benefits of others and of the mindfulness of bodhicitta. Okay? So many benefits from doing this. Okay. Questions, comments?
Mm-hmm. When I do it, I'm often getting into the habit of trying to take in really big form.
Uh-huh.
And I'm taking more in, and then I try and do the same thing with the outer.
Okay, so when you're doing it with your breath, you're trying to make your in-breath and your out-breath really, really long so you have time to contemplate it, so you wind up feeling a little bit like this. That's why I said I think it's good if, you know, at our level, we don't always put it with the breath, but we mostly do it without the breath so that we can really spend the time meditating, so that we can gain some feeling from it. Yeah, and then just sometimes do it with the breath. Yeah.
When I first started doing Kanban, I was really surprised that the end feeling is happiness. Because when I heard about it, it sounded awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then began to try it, and it felt like such an interesting turn that occurs in there.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking on suffering, which you get this resistance to, like, I don't want to, you know, and then somehow that goes, mm-hmm. and it goes up. And then the happiness seems to come from this imagination of the other being the being. And
mm-hmm.
you see their joy, and even while you're thinking suffering, you feel happy.
Yeah.
It still puzzles me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not describing it, and it still puzzles me.
Okay.
My usual mind says it shouldn't work that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're saying that it's a puzzle to you why, when you take on suffering and give happiness, why the end result of this meditation is that you're happy yourself. Because
yeah.
you said when you do it and you imagine taking on suffering, you imagine them being freed of suffering, and that makes you feel happy. And that puzzles you why you would feel happy. But I think we have this natural sense of empathy with other living beings. And when others are in pain, we feel pain because we know what it's like. And when we can see their pain being alleviated, then we feel it just as we would our own pain. I think there's some natural way we have of understanding what other people are experiencing and sympathizing and empathizing with them. Yeah? So,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's just the launching the you know, I mean, now that I'm saying it, it's like the logic doesn't pan out, but the actual...
Yeah. Well, from the viewpoint of the self-centered thought that says,
yeah.
I'm only happy when I get benefit, then the logic doesn't pan out, because I'm not getting benefit, I'm getting suffering.
Yeah.
Okay? But when you think from outside the viewpoint of the self-centered thought, because the self-centered thought, remember, is a liar... Yeah, and you think outside that, then, yeah, imagining others or even freeing others from suffering, wow, what a wonderful experience that would be for yourself. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, that's our experience. I mean, that's why His Holiness says, you know, my religion is kindness, because, I mean, you're a mother. You used to wake up in the middle of the night and calm this screaming baby, you know? And it gave you happiness to take care of this baby. Well, by the rules of the self-centeredness, it shouldn't. Yeah? But by the rules of just basic human nature and wanting to prevent the suffering of somebody you care about and seeing another living being happy, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
That's a good phrase, the logic of the self-centered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's slightly more realistic. Well, I don't know whether that's the right term, but that is again, you know, waking up at the night and empathizing with your baby
mm-hmm.
is, you know, another small, relatively small mm-hmm. suffering that you're taking on.
Mm-hmm.
Wandering around a refugee camp in Goma, you know, mm-hmm. in DRC, in the Congo,
mm-hmm.
there are hundreds of thousands of people. Completely destitute,
mm-hmm.
all hungry, many, many sick, many, many dying, the human reaction is to kind of, it's really hard to empathize and want to take on that suffering.
Mm-hmm.
To protect yourself, the human reaction, so I'm speaking from experience, is to kind of not empathize.
Uh-huh.
I just have to shut up, because if I empathize, I'll be useless in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to help these people, and if I start taking on their suffering, I won't be able to resolve I'll just be on the ground crying.
Okay. So, you're saying from another perspective, from your own experience, you know that, like, if you're working in a refugee camp where there's so many people who are starving and in misery, you're feeling that if you took on their suffering, you would become immobilized. And so you have to block that in order to be able to actually benefit them. That again, I think, is the logic of the self-centeredness. I think when we really understand this meditation deeply, we can still do that. Because I think what's happening with what you said is that we are feeling their suffering, and it's turning into personal distress. And so we're feeling so much personal distress that we say, I have to block being sensitive to their suffering, because I'll get overwhelmed by my own distress and then I can't function. But I think if you really focus on their suffering with the viewpoint of a bodhisattva, which you didn't know at the time when you were doing this, yeah, with the viewpoint of a bodhisattva, of things are produced by causes and conditions, and, you know, I can't undo other people's causes and conditions. I have to have equanimity now in the face of their suffering, but I can help them in the future to have better causes and conditions. So there is hope, there is a reason for optimism, that if you think like that, then you can look at their suffering and deal with it, rather than feeling that you have to block it out. Because you know that there actually is a way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And this is the viewpoint, I think, that's very special about the Dharma. Yeah, is that we're looking beyond this lifetime. Maybe I can't help every single living being in this refugee camp, you know, recover. But through my practice, and even through giving a smile, yeah, I can help as much as I can and improve myself spiritually so that in the future I'll be able to benefit even more. Okay? And that you see that the suffering is created by causes and conditions, you know, and so, you know, and this is a good way, when you see others suffering, rather than get so, like, bummed out about it and everything, we create a sense of equanimity. Now, equanimity does not mean apathy. It does not mean apathy. It means you see the suffering. It's right there. You see it. You're not hiding it. You're not blocking anything. But you're not letting your mind go to personal distress. Instead, you're keeping your mind with equanimity. Why? Because you know that all this suffering is the ripening of karma. And that as the karma is ripening, or after it's ripening, there's nothing you can do. You know? So then you know, okay, this was the product of karma. You learn a lot from that. But you know, oh, I can help them so they don't create the same karma in the future. Yeah? And if there's social structures or individuals who are causing this harm to others, you think, I want to help those people so that they don't wind up being born as this in the future as a result of their negative karma for greedily making other people experience this. We have to stop now. Remind me tomorrow, or next week, beforehand because I got a letter from one of the inmates about how he used taking and giving that's very, very moving, and I wanted to read it to you, but I forgot it tonight, so remind me next week, okay? It's quite a touching story.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all other inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds all.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born or us and grow. May the born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tending death of Chen Rezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Flourish.